And we're holding our mom and draws on with days, three lines from the bottom. We must just turn on that bottom. We learn in a blaiser. Yod for Zeus Smol. When the Torah tells us, that you should put tefillin, al yod for, that means specifically the left hand, the left arm. So how do you know? In El Yamin, maybe it means the right arm. Therefore, we find several psukim where we find that the word yod unspecified means the left arm. First of all, the pasuk where Hashem says, "Ach yodi yosar," it's indeed my hand has founded the earth. The mincha, the mini, and my right hand, tipcha shamayim, has set up the heavens. So in other words, Hashem is saying, "I created both heaven and earth." But we see that the pasuk is using the word yodi, and then yemini. So yemini means my right hand. So therefore, by elimination, yodi means my left hand. For Omer, and we have a similar pasuk. It says about in Devorah's song when she talks about Yoel killing Sisera, Yodola Yosid Tishnachna. She sent forth her hand to the peg, the Yemina, and her right hand, Lahalmus Amelim, to the hammer of the weary. You know, she took, as we know from the pasuk, she took a tent peg and hammered it into Sisera's skull and killed him. So, but we see, in other words, again, what the pasuk is saying first, that she sent forth her hand, and then her right hand, so then that means that hand, unspecified, means the left hand. The Omer, and you have yet another pasuk. We say to Hashem, Lama Sashiv Yadcha, why are you holding back your hand? V'minecha mekerev chek chachalai, and remove your right hand from your bosom. In other words, the composer of that kapitel tilim, Asaf, is saying to Hashem, like Hashem, you're sitting there with folded hands and not helping us. So instead, take out your left hand and your right hand from your yodcha, would mean your left hand, the minecha would mean your right hand, and remove them from your bosom. In other words, remove them from just being wrapped up in your clothing, so to speak, and inactive, and show them and use them on our behalf. So we see from all those psukim then that the word yod, without specifying, means the left hand. Tosfos points out, by the way, earlier in the Masechta, we learned about that when it says by the Metzora, it says that the blood is put on his ear, on his right ear and right thumb and right toe, and there it specifically says Yad Yeminoi. So why can't we learn from that? Tosfos points out that, you know, there we're talking about the hands, here we're talking about the arms, so it's not really the same thing. Therefore, the Gemara needs other facilities. However, Rabbi Yosi Achorim says, you know what? You do find that sometimes you find a pasuk where the right hand is called Yad. As we find by Yad Yosef ki Yoshes over Yad Yemino. We find when Yad was benching Menashe and Ephraim, and he puts his right hand on Ephraim and his left on Menashe, and then Yosef saw that and he was upset because he thought that Yaakov doesn't know what he's doing and Menashe is the before and he should be doing that. So we see therefore that it's called Yad. The Idah, what is the Tanakhama answer to that? Yad Yemino Ikri, Yad Stamala Ikri. Fine, it's called Yad Yemino, but you don't see where it's called Yad Unspecified. Now, why is Tanakh called Rabbi Yosi HaChorim? Rashi says the word Chorim, or Chorum, means somebody where the bridge of his nose is sunken in. So therefore, he was called that because that's what he looked like. Tosfos objects. I mean, that doesn't seem right to call the person a nickname based on his physical deformity. You're not supposed to do that. Rather, Tosfos says he's called that because of the name of the place he came from. Shittim Ukubetis brings from a different collection of Tosfos called Tosfos Chatzonius that maybe in fact the word is not Hachorim with a mem, but maybe Hachoris or Hacheres. In which case it would mean he came from a town called Timnas Heres, which was the town where Yeshua lived and was buried, or Ir Haheres, a city in Egypt. So therefore, see, he called Rabbi Yosi Hahores or Haheres or whatever, or Hahores after the name of the place he came from. On the other hand, Ben Yehoyada points out, you know, maybe what it is that there was a nest that happened to him, which the result of the nest was he ended up with a deformed nose, or the other way around, that maybe the fact that he had a deformed nose saved him at one point, and therefore from then on they called him that. So therefore it's not a gnai, it's not an embarrassment to call him that. On the contrary, then says Ben Yehoyada, maybe every time you call him that, then it reminds us of the nest that happened to him because involving the bridge of his nose. Rabbi Levick, that his father has an interesting, as a whole, an interesting explanation of it. He explains basically that the Rabbi Yosi Achorim, he says, represents Dvorah. So like this, I'll go, a regular nose, which is called choy tem in Hebrew, with a tes, represents chesed, or represents teferes, or I forget what he says exactly it represents, but in any case, Rabbi Yosi choy reim, whereas Rashi says, has a differently shaped nose than a regular person, he represents more gvura, and therefore we mention his title in this connection, because he's trying to explain that after all, the word yad sometimes, therefore, we don't really have. Therefore, you're telling me that the word yad, unspecified, always means the left hand, is the hand of gvura. But I can show you that even that the word yad, representing gvura, sometimes even means the right hand. In other words, in effect, he's saying like as if like both hands represent gvura. Whereas the Tanakhama again answers that no, because we see that it's called yad yamin, but we never find it called yad plain. Okay. So all of this is one way of learning that tefillin are placed on the left arm, because the Torah says that it should go on yod, and yod unspecified, we're saying, means the left arm. But Rav Nosson Omer Ein Efsaga. Rav Nosson says you don't need that. I have a different source from which I can show that it goes on the left arm. Harehu Omer, the pasuk says Ukshavtam Ukshavtam. The pasuk says you should tie tefillin on your arm, and then the next pasuk says you should write mezuzahs. So Maksiva B'Yamin, just like writing is generally done with the right hand. Most people are righties and they write with their right hand. Akshira B'Yamin, the same way the tying the tefillin on also has to be done with the right hand. Given the kshira b'yamin, and necessarily, if you're tying them on with the right hand, of necessity, you're putting it on the left hand, on the left arm, because it wouldn't be physically possible to tie on with the same hand that you're putting it on the upper arm of. This is the source we're going to talk about in the next couple of minutes. We're going to talk about lefties, where they put tefillin, and this point that you want to mention, that Rav Nosson mentions, the point about writing, and that most people write with their right hand, is one of the is a source for the distinction that the post distinctions the post can talk about when you have a person who uses his right hand to write and uses his left hand for other things, or vice versa, which what determines what his dominant hand is as far as tefillin. So we'll talk about it soon. We'll get into more after the Gemara establishes over here what a lefty should do. Okay, so then Rav Nosson says, so that's another way of learning that the tefillin are on the left arm, because you have to tie them on with your right hand. So the question is, Rav Yosi Achodem Hanocha B'Bismil Manolad. Well, Rav Yosi Achodem had objected to the Tanakhama. He said, you're telling me that you learn it from the word yod, because the yod sometimes means the right hand. Well, where does Rav Yosi Achodem learn that the tefillin are placed on the left hand, on the left arm? He certainly doesn't disagree with that. The answer is Nafkalema. Hefer de Nafkalema Rav Nosson. Fine, he uses the same Dirata that Rav Nosson does of Ukshavtam Ukshavtam, the Hetlish over there. Rav Ashi says there's another way we can learn that tefillin go on the left arm. The pasuk says yod chaksiv. The pasuk says you should place it on yod chas. It's written with a hey in the parasha of Ahoy Kiviyachon, the second time that the Torah mentions the mitzvah of tefillin. It says Ahoyah la'oisal yod cha, and the word yod cha there is spelt with a hey. So therefore, we learn from that it means yod chaksiv the hey kei. So therefore, it means the weaker arm. It actually says two explanations. One is because it says with a hey, therefore a hey is usually a marker of the feminine, so therefore it means, like, so to speak, feminine hand, the weaker hand. Women generally have less physical strength than men, and therefore so the yod cha with the feminine suffix would mean the weaker arm, which would mean the left arm. The second explanation, it actually says, is that we take the word yod cha and break it up. Yod dalet means the hand, and cha, keha, top hey, means keha, means weak. So you learn it like that. Rab Abba asked Rab Ashi, how do we know we should daushen it like that? If you're telling me that we daushen it from that, we often find in the Torah where a hey and a ches are daushen interchangeably. There's many cases where we have a word written with a hey and we daushen as though it was written with a ches or vice versa. So in that case, maybe when it says yod cha, maybe we should daushen it as if it said yod koyach, and on the contrary, it means the stronger one. Amalei, but Rav Ashi answered, Nitziv b'ches. After all, it doesn't say with a ches, it says with a hey. So in other words, Mela, yes, sometimes we do have drushas that are interchangeable like that. But here, But here, if you did like that, if you had him, in other words, if you darish it, when can you darish in a hey interchangeably with a ches when they wouldn't contradict one another like that? If you have, for example, one example of a drasha of a hey representing a ches, the Yerushalmi mentioned one of the ways in which we know the hints of the 39 malachas is because it's Eila Hadvarim, the word Eila, Aleph Lamed Hey, we darish in the hey as though it was a ches, and then Aleph Lamed Ches equals 39. Fine, but that doesn't contradict the actual meaning of the word Eila. So therefore, we can darshan it that way. But when you have over here, to darshan with a hey would mean the weaker hand, and to darshan with a ches, on the contrary, would be the stronger hand, and they contradict one another, then obviously we have to go according to what it actually says Rav Ashi. So the more points out to Tanoi, this is actually a machlokas Tanoi. Whether we darshan this point about the tefillin being on the left arm, whether we darshan it from the word, from the word yodcha, or whether we darshan it from someplace else. The Braisa says Yod Chabahei, Zu Yad Smo, and it says Yod Chabahei means left arm, either because it's according to either of the explanations that Rashi says, either because the hey marks the feminine, so it means the weaker, or because we darshan Yad Keha, the weaker hand. So Zu Yad Zu Smo, that means the left hand. Achere Boimim, whereas Achere, which usually means your mayor, says, no, from Yodcha, the rabbis is a gidin. From the word Yodcha, we're deriving a different din, namely that if a person has his hand amputated, so now, in other words, Yodcha will also mean not weaker as in the left arm weaker than the right arm, but he's still, they both function normally, but rather a person whose arm is weakened by having damaged, broken and damaged, Rashi says, by having his hand, or some part of his arm amputated. So nevertheless, I heard him say that he still has to put on tefillin shel yad on that. So the post can talk about to what it means is, in other words, obviously if he's missing his left arm entirely, he can't very well put on tefillin. That's the next thing the Gemara is going to discuss. So let's see. Okay, so the point is, in other words, we have a machlokas tanoim whether in fact we learn from Yod Chol, like Rav Ashi says, or whether we don't. So the Gemara says, Tanya Idach, we learn in another Braisa, Misha Eimoy Zroya, if a person does not have a left arm, Potim and Atfilin, then according to the Tanakhama, he would be Potim and Atfilin altogether. We wouldn't say he should put it on his right arm, he just doesn't put it on entirely. Achirim say, on the contrary, the word yodcha comes to include somebody whose arm is amputated, and nevertheless he still has to put on tefillin. Tosfos points out they're not really arguing. Tosfos says they're not really arguing. If he still has enough of a left arm, then he would put tefillin on there. And if not, if he has no left arm at all, though, then he doesn't put on tefillin on his arm at all. Then he only puts on tefillin on his head. On the other hand, Shitimu Kubetzis brings from the filter that says that no, if a person is missing his left arm, he would actually have to put tefillin completely. Then he would have to put tefillin on his right. There was a well-known story involving an Israeli soldier, I think in the Yom Kippur War. I don't remember exactly where he was in tremendous danger during the war, and he, up until that point, he hadn't been putting on tefillin, and he promised Hashem that if he gets out of the safely, he'll start putting on tefillin every day. Then, in the battle, he was injured, and after his left arm was blown off. Can't put on tefillin anymore, so he felt very bad about it. What's this? I promised Hashem that I'm going to put on tefillin. Now he took away that opportunity from me. So the guy was very, very sad and depressed for a while. Eventually, to make a long story short, a bunch of wounded Israeli soldiers were brought for a special Fabrengen with the Rebbe in 1976 or so. That was where the Rebbe dubbed them instead of full. He said they call you in the Israeli bureaucracy Nechi Yisrael, the Israeli handicap. Instead, we should call you Mitzioni, so all the special, the unique ones of Israel. In any case, I don't remember if it was that occasion or a different occasion, whatever, that ever told this guy, I think it was that ever told the guy in a letter, basically. I don't remember exactly, but basically that you think, in other words, that Hashem saved you just so you could do something for him. Hashem wanted to demonstrate with that he's saving you even if you can't do something for him afterwards just because he loves you. So therefore, in token of that, like, you can't put on tefillin on your arm anymore, but nevertheless, Hashem daft to save you in that way in order to demonstrate, if not, he's saving you because now I want you to do something for me, he's saving you because he loves you, period. But in any case, so that's how it is then. So if a person is missing his left arm, then he doesn't put it on at all, but if he's missing part of it, then he still puts on tefillin on the left arm. We learn in a brisa. Iter maniach tefillin b'yeminoi. A left-handed person puts on tefillin on his right arm, because again, if the idea is, as we're saying before, that it has to be on the non-dominant arm, then it means, in his case, that would be on the right arm. So the Gemara says, so therefore he puts it on his right arm, shehu smolei, which is, for him, that's his left, in other words, it's his weaker hand, his weaker arm, and therefore that's where he puts it. So the Gemara asks about Tanya maniach the smolei. Another Braisa says that he does put it on his left hand, through smolei shokol adam, which is the equivalent of everybody else's left. So what are you telling me? He puts it on his right. And the answer is, Amarabai, ki Tanya he b'shoy that b'shteyot. That last brisa is talking about where he's ambidextrous. He uses both hands equally strongly, so therefore you can't say there's one weaker and one stronger. So fine, relative to him, both of them are a right arm in effect. But nevertheless, since neither of them is weaker, then therefore we don't have him put tefillah on the opposite arm. Instead, we have him put tefillah on his right, on his left, like everybody else, because for most people that is the left arm. So now, when we talked before about ksiva b'yamin, kshita b'yamin, that the writing is done with the right hand, and similarly the tying. So Tosfos brings up the question, what if a person writes with his right hand and does most other things with his left hand? So which one would he put tefillin on? So Tosfos says we would consider him ambidextrous, so he would put tefillin on his left arm. There is an enormous amount of discussion about that among the various Rishonim and Achronim, about the ins and outs of that. When do we say that? When do we say there might even be cases where such a person actually has to put tefillin on both arms, would not at the same time, but there might such a person might have to, in some cases, put tefillin on his left arm and then afterwards take him off and put him on his right arm. Among the many, many different poskim, we've talked about that. We showed him and Achronim. And Tzemach Tzedek has a couple of truvas about it, because the Tzemach Tzedek himself had a son who was in that situation, who wrote with one hand and did various other things with his left hand. And the question is which one is considered his dominant hand for this purpose. So in general, the posts can say that because the Gemara had singled out writing over here, then therefore that means writing is equal in importance to all the other actions that a person does, and therefore if a person writes with his right hand and does everything else with his left hand, then generally he would put tefillin on his left arm, but nevertheless there are some various cases where a person also, what if a person tackle writes with both hands? What if he does some things with one and some things with the other? So you have a wide variety of different cases, and there are in fact some cases, as the Tzemach Tzedek says, and as other posts can talk about, where he tackle would have to put tefillin on both arms. Then you also have the question, let's say, for example, a lefty who trained himself to write with his right hand, and then you have all kinds of other interesting permutations like that. Now that we established which arm the tefillin goes on, let's talk about where on the Tonad Menashe. We learn in a Braisa from the Yeshiva of Menashe. Al Yodcha, when the Torah says to place the tefillin, Al Yodcha Zu Kiburis. That means the kiburis. Kiburis, the Tosfos points out, literally means a gathering. So it means a place where there's a gathering of flesh, a muscle, in other words. So in fact, Rashi translates it with the word fradrono, or however it's pronounced in French, which means a muscle. Tosfos gets into an interesting discussion over here. Which muscle do we mean? I mean, your whole arm has muscles on it. So Tosfos says, it does not mean the muscles of the forearm. It doesn't mean between the wrist and the elbow. It means specifically the muscles between the elbow and the shoulder. From Rashi it seems to come out any place in that area would be fine, but Tosfos explains that no, it means zafka on the muscle. And Tosfos gets into an interesting discussion about the names of the different parts of the arm and the leg in halacha, which is relevant to this and relevant to various other areas of halacha as well. In any case, you have to put it on the muscle. A lot of the poskim explains that preferably it should be on the lower half of it, the half of the muscle that's closer to the elbow. But yeah, but they talk about that if you do it on the upper half, then it's not so bad, but it has to be someplace on that muscle, and ideally on the lower half. So that's where you put it. And Vein Einecha Zukodfoy. And Tonad Rei Menashe says, when we say that you have to put tefillin, Vein Einecha, between your eyes, doesn't actually mean between your eyes, it means Zukodfoy, it means on the skull, on the height, on the top part of the skull. So it must say Heifa, where exactly? Amid Vein Einecha, Mokum Shemloicha Shaltinik Reifus. It's a place where where a baby's head pulsates. When a baby is born, it's its skull. The plates of its skull are not joined and fused together yet. You have spaces over there, the fontanelle, it's called in English, where you can see in a baby, you can see the heartbeat and the brain pulsing. That's the highest part. That's the highest area for the tree. Tosfos points out that the Gemara is going to say later on, and it has to be in an area that grows hair and which is subject to the dinim of Negoyim, which is subject to the dinim of Saras of hair. So therefore, it has to be above the hairline. It has to be above the hairline, but it has to be below Mokum Shemoshu Tinek Reif. So you have this doing that. So all the posts can talk about, you have to be careful not to allow the tefillin to droop below the hairline. Many times people get older, either the straps of their tefillin get looser or whatever the reason, or they forget where their hairline was and their tefillin ends up being below the hairline. They have to be careful to put it in the right place. And then the upper maximum is that place of the fontanelle. So on the base, the Gemara will explain how we know that. So the Gemara says, Plimoy Merebi. Plimoy asked Rebbe a question. Plimoy was, he's mentioned in a few places in Shas. Some say that Plimoy might be an alteration or another way of saying the word Ploini, which means we don't know his name and we're just saying like anonymous. Others say that Plimoy is an actual name and they trace it to one or another possible Greek name that has similar consonants. Palaimon is one of them. Philemon is another. Whatever the case, so we find them in here and there in Shas. So Plimoy asks them. If somebody has two heads, the A's in the head, maniach tefillin, which one should he put tefillin on? Now, it sounds like a joke. A person with two heads. So Rebbe was very offended by that. So Rebbe tells him, Oi kungli, either get up and go to Golos because you're insulting me. Oi kabel alach shamta, or you're going to have to accept on yourself nidui for insulting a talmud chacham. Like you're coming and giving me you're coming and joking to me in an inappropriate way that's not the public for the nasi for the nasi of the Jewish people. So in other words, Rebbe is saying it's an impossible case. What are you going to ask him? Well, Adahochi, as they were talking, Osahu Gavra, a certain person came along with a shayla. Omalei, he says, Isuli li yinuka di ista treire. My wife just had a baby with two heads. Kamabrin and Lamesa, Lakoyan. How much do I need to give for pidyon ben to the Koyan? He's a bechor. So do I need to give 5 soyim because it's one baby, or 10 because it's two heads, or 10 soyim because it's two heads, 5 apiece? So we see, in other words, Hashem brought Bashbacha Protest that this guy should show up right then in order to save Plimoy from being punished by Rebbe. So yes, sir, it turns out that such a thing is in fact possible. Tosfos points out that Tosfos actually brings that you don't find that kind of thing in this world, with the exception, I guess, of this guy. But Tosfos brings from the Medrash that Ashmedai one time brought out Ashmedai, the king of the Shadim, brought out from underground a person with two heads and brought him to Shlomo HaMelech. This guy married a regular woman, and they ended up having children who also had two heads. They had one child who had two, he had a child with one head, with two heads, like himself, and then he had several other children with one head each, like his wife. So now, the story continues, Tosfos says that eventually the father with the two heads passed away, and the children came to Shlomo to dispute the inheritance. The one with the two heads claimed that he should get double as much because he has two heads. Everybody else claimed you have only one body, you get one portion. So Tosfos stops the story over there and doesn't say what the verdict was. Shutim Kubetzis brings from a different collection of continues from the same Medrash. What happened was Shlomo was being the Chacham Mikol Adam, after all, he was the wisest of all men. Shlomo did a test as follows. He covered up one of the heads and took boiling water and poured it onto the other head. And both the heads started yelling out from the pain. So Shlomo says, you see that it's really only one person. So he may have two heads, but it's really only one person, and he gets only one portion of inheritance. So again, this guy in Rebbe's times comes and says, my wife had Siamese twins, with a baby with two heads, and how much do I have to give for pidyon aben? Also, who's Sava? A certain old Talmud Chacham came along, turned away, and taught him a braisa that says, Chayiv l'tan lo asara sloim. He would, in fact, have to give him 10 sloim. Now, why is that? Rashi explains like this. We're going to learn in the Sefer Bechoros, next to you, Yud-Ez Hashem, that when you have, when twins are born, if you suppose regular twins, where one twins that have one head each, then even if we don't know which one was born first, you only have to give 5 sloim to the Kohen. Why? Because we say, E-Epshel Atzamsen. It's impossible to say with certainty that they both came out at the same moment. Very possibly one of them came out a fraction of a second before the other. We don't know which one it is, fine. But we can do the pidyon of that anyway, but therefore you only have to give 5 sloyim because it's only one bechor. But over here, because it's a two-headed baby, it's very possible that both heads actually literally came out in the same moment, and therefore that means each one of them is equally peter rechem, and therefore you would have to give 10 sloyim. So that's the answer to the man's question. So the Gemara says, Eini, is that so? Why should he have to do Pidyon HaBen at all? V'altoni Rami Bahama, didn't Rami Bahama teach a Braisa? Mitoch Shenema Pode Sifta Eis V'chor HaAdam, the Pasuk says you have to do Pidyon HaBen, Shemeani after the Nitrach V'sech Shloshim Yoim, you would think that applies even if the baby was killed during the first 30 days. Rashi explains Nitrach means killed. We'll talk about that in a second, what Tosfos says. So you would think that nevertheless the father still has to do pidyon aben, because in other words, it actually says it's one thing that the pasuk says you do pidyon aben after a month. So that would mean, in other words, so you could say, in other words, if within a month you don't have to do it, but if the baby was killed, Rahman al-Fran, within the first month, we have every reason to think that he would have survived 30 days, and therefore maybe you should retroactively be chayav in pidyon aben. No, therefore the pasuk says ach pode sifte. So the ach is a mute, cholak therefore divides it and says that if the baby died or was killed during the first 30 days, that he's potter. Now Rashi continues, this baby is the pashtus not going to survive. Okay, we have Tosfos' story with a guy who was brought from underground by Ashmedai, but fine, that's the underground, there can be different other fantastical creatures such as that, and fine. When he has children with his wife, then they can also be two headed. But a regular, normally a two headed baby, the Gemara assumes, is not gonna survive. So he's not gonna survive 30 days. So why should you need to do pidyon aben at all? And the answer is shiny hafa. It's different over here. The gugolos tola rachmana, because the pasuk makes it depend on gugolos. The pasuk says you have to take 5 shkolim la gugolos for each head, and that hints at the idea that even if the baby has 2 heads and nevertheless is a trefa, nevertheless he is going to be chayiv in pidyon aben. So in other words, Rashi explains that our understanding about Trefa is one thing. If the baby was Nitzrach, if the baby was Chas V'Shalom killed during the first 30 days, then you're right, he's potter from Pidyon HaBen. But here, the baby is alive, fine, he may not live very much longer, because a Trefa usually is not going to live 12 months, but nevertheless, he has survived 30 days, and therefore he's Chayiv in Pidyon HaBen, and as Ahu Sova, that old Talmud Chacham, taught the Braisa, in fact, the father is going to be Chayiv in a double Pidyon HaBen in 10 sloim. Tosfos has a long discussion about this and explains we don't mean nitzrach over here. It doesn't mean killed. It means nitzrach means trefa. So in other words, the idea is because even if he lives, so even if he actually lives more than 30 days, then fine. Nevertheless, it's still by definition a trefa because we have a rule in halacha called yeser kenotel dami. We're going to learn it in Kolei Besif and later this year. Any time that you have a vital organ, which is an extra one, then halacha considers it as though that organ is missing. A head, of course, is a vital organ. So therefore, if he has 2 heads, it's considered as though he has no head, and therefore, so he's considered a trefa in halacha. We assume he's not going to live 12 months, and nevertheless, though, and the Braisa had said that such a baby is not chayav in pidyon aben, but the answer is other kinds of trefas, other kinds of excess organs, other kinds of duplicated organs. Yes, we would say that, but a head specifically, since the Torah says gugolos, then therefore it's different, and in fact, it grows according to the number of heads, and therefore, this father will not only be chayav in pidyon aben, what will be chayav in a double one, 10 sloim. There is quite a bit of joke. There is some interesting discussion about this. First of all, there's an interesting Chassam Sofer that says on this, we find when Hashem tells Moshe to count the Jewish people, he tells him to count them the gugloisim, according to their heads. Literally, gugloisim means their heads or their skulls. But we don't find, when it says by Shevet Levi, we don't find that Hashem told him to do that. Why not? So Sam Sofer says an interesting idea based on our Gemara. Conceivably, there might be Levi parents who had a baby with two heads. Now, when it comes to Bnei Yisrael, when it comes to the rest of the Shvatim, they're counted only from age 20 and up. By that point, as we're saying over here, as Tosfos is saying over here, the baby won't have survived that long, because with two heads, he's a tereka, he won't live past 12 months. Therefore, by the time it comes to counting Bnei Yisrael from age 20 and up, by definition, every person is going to have one head, an exact one and only one head, and therefore you can count by heads. Whereas by the Levium, says Bachsan Sofer, you can't do that, because what if there's a baby more than the Levium will count in from 30 days old and older? So what if you have a baby between 30 days and 12 months old who has two heads? You shouldn't count them double, because for the purposes of that census, we're counting people, not heads. And therefore, the Torah leaves out the word Legolgolos over there, implying count the people, don't count the number of heads, because then you may come up with extra if there are any Siamese twins among them. So on the face of it, it comes out from our Gemara that such babies are not going to live. On the other hand, Achronim discuss different other possibilities and say that actually the conclusion of the Gemara may actually be. So first of all, so some of the Forshim explain that even so, that doesn't, that still, Rebbe has now found that fine, it's possible for there to be a baby born with two heads, as we see this guy says, that he just came and asked about Pidyon HaBen, but nevertheless, the objection to what Plimoy asks is still valid, some of the Forshim point out, because after all said and done, a guy, if we're saying he's going to be a Tzedeker, he's going to live, he's going to die before he's 12 months old, well then he's not going to live long enough to ever put on tefillin, so then what's Plimoy asking? On the other hand, there are Mephoshim who learn that the Gemara is now going back on what it said before and saying that after all, even though, as Tosfos points out, there is a number of Achronim point out, the Reb Chaim Brisker and the Chacham Tzvi and several others point out that the Tosfos is mentioning the technicality that yes, Kol Yesser Kenotol Dami. Nevertheless, in practice, we don't always see that. Sometimes we see an animal or a person that's born with extra vital limbs, and nevertheless, they go on to live. Therefore, the Gemara may conclude that after all, not only can such a baby be born and live to at least 30 days old, but maybe even they could live to much older, maybe even they could live long enough to the point where they would be putting on tefillin, and therefore, Plimoy's question is in fact valid. As a matter of drasha, actually, Abboina in Ein Yaakov points out that a deeper meaning of the question is that Plimoy is asking, if you have a person who has two heads, like he's a split personality, he's very much into, he loves Hashem, and he wants to be close to Hashem, but he's also into taivas of this world. So like, which one is it more important for him to put tefillin on and to redirect to Hashem? So Rebbe gets angry at the question from Plimoy. What kind of a question is that? Of course, yes. The person shouldn't be like that. And if he is, then yeah, what are you asking? Which one? He has to work on both of them. And then, in fact, this guy comes with this question about his baby that was born, from which we see that such a thing is possible. And yes, in fact, what does Pidyon HaBen represent? That this baby belongs to Hashem, and you have to, so to speak, redeem him and buy him back from the Kohen, from the Kohen, so therefore it represents, yes, if you have a person who has a split personality like that, then yes, he is actually obligated to devote both of his heads, both of the parts of his personality, to Hashem, and not think one it's good enough if one of them is for Hashem, and the other one not. So now, getting back to the Braisa on Amar Aleph, Amar, we said, Al Yod Chazuk Kiboris, the Braisa from Tanan Bre Menashe, and Amar Aleph had said that when it says you should put tefillin, Al Yodcha means on the biceps. So Menolon, where do we know that from? So the Tanan Abam, we learn in Braisa. The Pasuk says Al Yod Chazuk Goyva Shabiyad. Again, another Braisa says that Al Yodcha means the elevated part of the arm, meaning in other words the upper arm. So it comes out from. So again, it comes out from Rashi that apparently any place. So Rashi just says kibbutz juhu etzalak chasim. Rashi says the muscle, the biceps, which is near the shoulder. So it seems that Rashi would hold that any part of the upper arm is valid for tefillin. But on the other hand, we said on Amud Aleph that Tosfos says that no, it has to be dafka on the muscle, on the biceps. Anyway, so zugoyvish of the yad, so it means the highest part of the arm. After omer zugoyvish of the yad, so you're saying that's what it means. Oy ena el al yod chamamish. Maybe it means literally on the hand. Maybe you should put tefillin shoyad on the hand. Nope. We can learn that not, because omra torah hanach tefillin beyad, v'hanach tefillin berosh. Because the Torah tells us to put tefillin on the hand and on the head. Now, where do we put it on the head? Malahalam the Gurva Shabarosh. Now, with tefillin, you're putting it on the highest part of the head, as I was going to explain soon. Akan, the Gurva Shabiyad, the same way when you're putting tefillin Shabiyad, has to be on the highest part of the arm. So, therefore, the upper arm, not the hand or the lower arm. Rabbi Eliezer says, I don't need that. I have a different way of learning that tefillin goes on the bicep, on the upper arm. The pasuk says, the pasuk says that tefillin should be for you a sign. That means that means tefillin should be a sign for you, not for others. They shouldn't be so visible. They shouldn't be so visible to others. If you put them on your hand, then they're clearly visible to everybody else. Therefore, necessarily, it has to mean on the upper arm, which is more or less, which is covered by your clothes. So Rabbi Eliezer says that's another way of learning. That's another way of learning. Therefore, that tefillin shel that tefillin shel yad go on the upper arm. So it comes out. In other words, that so Rashi is saying. Therefore, you don't put them on the hand. You put them on the biceps. But in other words, all it is Rashi is explaining the Gemara had first thought and put it on the hand. Now that not, then we understand like before it goes on the biceps. Chicken Professor explains a little differently that it just means the loy la'achirim lois will tell us you don't put it on the hand. Fine, but how do we know you don't put it on the forearm? How do we know you don't put it on something else? For that we need the next Yerusha, which is going to explain that we know that not. So the Gemara continues, Rabbi Yitzchak Omer, Ein Tzarich, Rabbi Yitzchak says, I don't need to learn it from these places you're learning it. Harehu Omer, the Pasuk says, V'samtem esvara eva al levavchem, the Pasuk says, you should place these words of mine on your heart, ukshautem, and you should tie them on your heart. So that means, in other words, tishatei sima k'neged alev, when you're placing these words of mine, the words of the parashiyas of tefillin, it should be placed near the heart. Well, therefore, it has to be on the biceps, which is right next to the heart. And in fact, Reb Chiya and Reb Acha, when they would put on tefillin, shoyad, they would make sure that the shoyad is tilted a little bit towards the heart. So in other words, you're putting it on the bicep. It's not just sticking straight out. You have it turned in. You have it turned in a little bit towards the body, so that's literally by the heart. Okay. The Gemara continues, Rav Ashi have a Yosef Tamei down there, right? Rav Ashi was sitting as a Talmud in front of a Meimer, have a Syria the Yodeh, there was a wound in his hand and a corresponding rip in his clothing. Rashi explains that a Meimer had an injury on his biceps, so now what he did is he had ripped open part of his sleeve over there so that it wouldn't press against the wound and irritate it, but he had tefillin on his biceps, and you can see them through the rip in the you can see them through the rip in his clothing. On the lace, Rav Ashi says, don't you hold of this drasha that he said that tefillin are supposed to be only a sign for you and not for others? Why are you allowing your tefillin to be visible? On the lace, Amema says, all it has to be is in the place of l'chol ha'ois. As long as it's in the place, generally speaking, is covered by your clothes, then we don't care if in this particular scenario the sleeve is ripped and you can see it, if the sleeve is rolled up or whatever. It's basically, it's in the place of l'chol ha'ois, and that's good enough. So that covers the shoyad, how we know that the shoyad goes on the upper arm and specifically on the biceps. Next. Next, we said that tefillin shorosh go on the that it goes on the upper part of the head. How do we know that? And in fact, we had used that according to the first explanation, the previous brisa. We used that even to demonstrate that the tefillin shoryad also go on the upper part of the arm. So in turn, where do we know the tefillin shorosh go on the top part of the head? The Tana Rabbanan. We learn it a brisa when it says bene neva. The word bene necha means the upper part of the head. After omer zugoy v'shabarosh, he's saying it means the higher part. Oyena ela bene necha mamish. Maybe it literally means bene necha. Maybe the tefillin shorosh are supposed to be actually between your eyes. No. Nemakan bene necha. Nemalahalon loy sasimu kolcha bene necha mames. Because we have a gzera shava. Here it says bene necha. Then the Torah tells us don't make a bold spot. Bein einechem for the dead. The goyim had a practice when a relative of theirs died, they would tear out their hair in grief and then make bald patches on their head. And the Torah is telling us, don't do that. Don't be like the goyim. Rashi makes a point over there. The pasuk says, and at the beginning of that pasuk, it says, "Bonimatam Hashem alakechem, your children of Hashem." So it's not for covetous that you, twins, that you, royal princes, children of Hashem, should be going around with gashes in your skin or bald spots on your head or whatever. Anyway, so Malahalam v'goyosh v'rosh. Now over there, it's talking on the actual upper part of the head, where on the scalp. Makom sha'oz v'kocha. In a place where it's possible to make a bald spot. Okay, sometimes you have people who have a unibrow, sometimes you have people who have their two eyebrows merged together in the middle, but generally most people don't. Usually most people have separate eyebrows with the bridge of the nose in between. So therefore, where is it possible to make a bald spot? On the higher part of the head, on the scalp. Achtan, the same thing with Tulin, it means on the scalp, Makom sha'oz v'kocha, the place where it would be possible to tear out hair and make a bald spot. So that's where we learn it from. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ein Tzarech. Again, Rabbi Yehuda says that you don't need. I have a different way of learning it. You can say as follows: Omra Torah Hanach Tefillin B'Yad, Hanach Tefillin B'Rosh. The Torah is telling you to put tefillin in two different places: on your body, on your arm, and on your head. Now, Malahalon. Now, what do we find as far as the area where you put the tefillin Shoyad? B'Makom Haroy LiTamei B'Nega Echol. It's a place which is capable of becoming tamei with only one type of tzaras. So in other words, you have, the Torah tells us in Parshas Tazria, you have, there's a type of tzaras that can come on regular skin, and then you have the type of tzaras that comes on the hair, on the scalp, or the beard, or the Gemara is going to explain now, that also means the eyebrows. Any place where you have a thick concentration of hair like that is subject to a different type of negoyim called a neset. The difference is regular tzaras involves a discoloration of the skin, and if there's two white hairs in it or different certain other things, then it's for sure tamei, as opposed to a nesek is an area where hair falls out. Whether there's a discoloration of the skin, as Machlokes Rishonim, the halacha is the Rambam passes that it does not. And if two yellowish golden hairs grow in it, then it's a sign of tamei. So, says Rabbi Yehuda, the upper arm is a place that's capable of only one kind of nega. Because, fine, you have a little bit of hair there, but not enough for it to qualify for nesakim. There it's just regular, whether it's just regular skin saras. So an afkan, the same thing. When it comes to the shorosh, then it also has to be, it has to be in a place which is capable of becoming tamei with one type of nega, one type of saras, namely only nesent. As opposed to between your eyes, in the area of the eyebrows, there you have, there's flesh, but there's bare skin, but there's also a heavy concentration of hair. There you have, there's two possible types of tzaras that could be in that area. Regular skin tzaras, where white hairs are a simen tumah, and Nesek, where yellow hairs are a simen tumah, and therefore the Torah is excluding by that. By comparing it to the Shoyad, that's not the place where you put tefillin. Rather, you put it on the scalp, where there's only one type of tzaras possible. So that's how we learn that tefillin goes on the upper part of the head. Tosfos wonders, maybe we should make a different comparison. Maybe we should say tefillin goes on bare skin. Maybe therefore the tefillin shoyad goes on bare skin on the arm. Maybe the tefillin shorosh should also go on bare skin, which would be his forehead. And Tosfos leaves the question open. Okay. So now we're done with the discussion of tefillin. Now we're going to move on to the discussion of tzitzis, which is going to take the last little bit of our perek over here. We'll learn a little bit of it today. We'll continue tomorrow. As the sham. And then the beginning of the next parak, the next few dafim of the next parak, are also going to talk all about the mitzvah and tzitzis. So the Mishnah said, "Arba tzitzis ma'akvas zuasu." The four tzitzis are ma'akav one another. Shabbatim mitzvah achas, because before the four of them constitute one mitzvah. In other words, the Tanakhama is saying, if you have a garment that has only three tzitzis on it, then you're not makayim the mitzvah. And when you have all four tzitzis on it, then you're makayim one mitzvah, namely to have tzitzis on your garment. But the Mishnah had said, Rabbi Shmuel says that the four of them constitute four separate mitzvahs. So the Mishnah says, "My benai." What is the actual argument between them? After all, they both agree you do need four tzitzis, Rashi points out. The Torah clearly says that you should place tzitzis al arba kanfas ksusa on the four corners, on the four corners of your garment. So they both agree you need four. So what's the actual difference between them? Mefarshim asked, what is the Gemara's question exactly? Kedushim am yafasim la Rashba points out, what do you mean? I mean, The obvious thing is that according to Rabbi Shmuel, the obvious question is that they're arguing is it considered one mitzvah or four mitzvahs, and then they have a considerable discussion about that. Rabbi Shmuel will say that they're four separate mitzvahs, but nevertheless, if he puts on a beged with only three of them, then sure he's being mevatel that mitzvah. So therefore, the Gemara is asking because you have no business wearing even according to Rabbi Shmuel one that has less than four tzitzis. So the Gemara says, I'm going to be a sodden with tzitzis ikabinai. The argument between them would be about a linen garment bearing tzitzis. As we're going to learn beginning in the next parak, your tzitzis are supposed to have tcheles in them. Tcheles is, by definition, is wool dyed with the tcheles dye, which we'll talk about in the next parak. So therefore, that means when you have a linen garment, if you're wearing tcheles, of necessity you're having woolen tzitzis on it. So then the argument would be, so now, if he put three tzitzis with tchelas on the beged and didn't put the fourth one, then according to the Chachamim, he's being over on the issur of shatnez without being mekayim the mitzvah. As opposed to, according to Rabbi Shmuel, he is being mekayim the mitzvah because according to him, each of the four tzitzis is a separate mitzvah. So in other words, Rabbi Yoshua explains, even though, fine, Rabbi Shmuel will agree that you don't really have the complete mitzvah until you have the four of them, he would say that each one of them by itself is important enough to override the issue of shot. So Rabbi Shmuel will agree you need all four of them to be the kind of mitzvah, but he will say that to override shot as it's good enough to only have three of them, says Rabbi Yoshua. The first one also talk about there's the point which the Gemara is going to talk about. So the Gemara is going to talk about the bottom of the armor. Let's say, for example, if a person was walking in the street and one of his tzitzis ripped off, is he going to have to take off the tzitzis at that point? If we consider it shatnez, he's going to have to. If we don't consider it shatnez, if we consider that the mitzvah of tzitzis is provides shatnez, then he doesn't have to. So that will be another way of looking at what Rabbi Yosef is saying. Rava Barahino gives a different answer. Talus balas chomish ikabinai. The argument between them would be if a talus has five corners, as the Gemara is going to talk about in a minute. Well, according to the Tanakhama, you still need only four tzitzis. If four of them constitute one mitzvah, and there's no mitzvah to put a fifth one. But according to Rabbi Shmuel, if every tzitzah constitutes a mitzvah of its own, then it would mean that you would actually have to put five tzitzis on it. So that would be another nafkamina between Rabbi Shmuel and the Tanakhama. Ravina Amar, Ravina gives another answer. The Rav Huna Ikebenai. They're arguing regarding the din that Rav Huna said. The Amar Rav Huna, Han Yotz V'Talus, She'enim Etzu Yetzis, Kil Chosim Shabbos. If a person were to go out on Shabbos wearing a talus which does not have the proper number of tzitzis in it, Chayiv Chatos, and he would be Chayiv Chatos for carrying on Shabbos. When the tzitzis are complete and the beged has all the tzitzis that it needs, then the tzitzis are considered a noi, they're considered a decoration for the garment, and therefore you're allowed to wear it out on Shabbos. It's just as you wear a garment with any other decoration in it. But when you don't have, when you have fewer than four tzitzis, then according to the Tanakhama, you're not accomplishing the mitzvah at all. And on the other hand, the tzitzis are not bottled to the beged because you do plan to add more tzitzis to it afterwards. So they have a hashivus. It's kind of the equivalent of you actually have a din, for example, if let's say you have a loose button on a coat. And you're actually planning to sew it up, then it's going to be a problem to wear it outside on Shabbos because it's not functional. You can't use it to button up the coat. But on the other hand, you do plan to fix it, so therefore it would be considered carrying. So here, in a similar vein, you have fewer than four tzitzis. The Tanakhama is going to say that you're not mekayim the mitzvah at all, and in fact you're being over on carrying on Shabbos. Whereas Rabbi Shmuel, since he holds that each tzitzah is a mitzvah of its own, then he's going to say that therefore you still are yurts. Meaning, in other words, it actually explains Rabbi Shmuel will agree with Rav Huna's din, but that would be, in other words, he would say Rav Huna's din would apply only when to begin with he only put three tzitzis on it. Or he did it in some other way where the tzitzis are possible, not three necessarily, but any other way where he did it in a way that's possible to begin with. So Rabbi Shmuel will agree that din applies then, that if he walks out with that on Shabbos, it's high of Chavis. Where it's missing one sitzah, and therefore, and according to Rabbi Shmuel, each one is a separate sitzah, then Rabbi Shmuel will hold. That's not the case. That opponent then applies to, and in fact, he is allowed to wear that outside on Shabbos, and it's not a problem. In this connection about a five-cornered garment, the Gemara says, "Amar of Shisha Breidah Idi, Haiman de Batzrei Leglime." If a person were to take his garment, which has four corners, and cut one corner on an angle, Or not on an angle. Rashi says in other words, he cuts a square out of it. So now you have two corners that are there. You have two right angled corners. What he did doesn't accomplish anything. It's not potter from tzitzis as a result of that. Shavya talis balas chomish. Now all he talis balas chomish. All he did is he made it into a five cornered garment. We just said according to Rabbi Shmuel, he would need five tzitzis. The halacha is not like that. The halacha is it needs four, as we're going to learn in the next parak. But nevertheless, he hasn't pottered it from tzitzis by doing that. Similarly, Omer Mesharshi, Haimad Tzairi Ligvidrei. Similarly, if a person were to fold up the corners of the talus and then sew it or otherwise change it, that it's going to remain that way or stick it, so it's going to remain that way permanently as a rounded corner. Also, like over the late form, he hasn't done anything either. It doesn't pop to it from tzitzis. My time and the command of Sharia dummy, because even though it's connected together, even though it's sewn or whatever, we still consider it as though it was unsewn. Because it's possible to take out the stitches or the glue or whatever, Rashi gives two explanations in here. The first explanation Rashi says is that Sire the Glime means that what he did is he had an extra long talus, he folded it in half, and decided he's going to put tzitzis on the corners of the fold. So now that's a problem. When he unfolds the talus, then those tzitzis are going to be in the middle. Are going to be in the middle of one of those corners. So therefore, it has to be dafka on the corners. So therefore, even now it's considered as though he put it on the corner. Rashi gives another explanation, another explanation is that he explains that what he did is he turned up the corners and folded them and sewed them, and nevertheless it's not considered rounded, it's still considered straightened out, it's still considered an actual corner because he's going to end up undoing it. In fact, we learn a Mishnah and Kalim along those lines. Any kind of skin bag that's used for any kind of liquid that is tied up. Now, usually you sew them to make them. You take the skin and you sew it in various places, and you have yourself a container. Here instead he knotted it in various places in order to make a utensil, in order to make a receptacle out of it. Nevertheless, it's not makabel tumah because it's not going to last like that. He's going to end up untying it, and therefore it doesn't have a receptacle. In fact, Rashi also adds that now it's going to have a hole in it big enough to moitzi rimon. It's going to have a hole in it big enough for pomegranates to fall out, and therefore it's not considered a table. Unfortunately, we'll explain that the Rambam and the Bartanura and the Mishnah explain that what it means is it was sewn up normally, but then there was a hole, and now instead of sewing up the hole, then now you tied it up. So in other words, when Rashi mentions the point over here about the remoinim, about pomegranates falling out, it can really mean both. In other words, that either it can mean both. It can mean whether it was not sewn to begin with, only knotted, or whether a hole developed and then he knotted it in that place instead of sewing it. In any case, so we see that just because it was tied, then it's not considered a kevi chutz mishal arvim, with the exception of the skin bags used by Arabs, because they do that normally, they tie it. So we see, therefore, that something tied or sewn or whatever is still not considered to be something permanently that way. So therefore, whether according to Rashi's explanation, according to the two different explanations of Rashi, that the first explanation means that the talus was extra long and he folded it and put the tzitzis in the middle, no good. Or according to the second explanation that he sewed up the corners and made them rounded, also no good. And the Gemara continues, a third din, omnib dimi min ha'udah, ta'iman d'chaite l'glimei. So before we were talking about sire l'glimei would mean that he tied it up and made it rounded, not that he actually sewed it. But now, dimi min ha'udah says, ta'iman d'chaite l'glimei, if he actually sewed it up, And he actually sewed it up, and to make a circular corner, Lloyd offered the leg to him. And also, what he did doesn't count for anything. I had sewn, unlike in the previous case where it was just folded up or tied or whatever. Because says you're giving me, it's a limited body leg. If he really doesn't need that part of the cloth, lipstick literally, then he would actually cut it off and throw it away. The fact that he didn't, the fact that he sewed it up, shows that eventually he has plans to untie it, to unsew it, to take out the stitches, and they could square it off again. And therefore, even now, it's tied in stitches. So you have, for example, capotas are commonly made. Sometimes the capota is slit enough up the back that constitutes a bag in the four corners, and therefore you'll find that often the manufacturer is making one corner of the capota rounded in order to avoid this issue. When they actually cut it and make it rounded, then that's fine. Then it's not five and sixes. But here we're talking about where it was rounded by tying it or by sewing it. Then we're saying that it's no good. That doesn't help for anything, and it's still higher than sixes. As far as the din of a folded over garment and putting sitzis on the corners of where it's folded now, Tosfos points out that actually they we're going to talk about that more in the next perek on Daf Lamalach. We'll talk about it in a few days, Bez Hashem, and we'll talk about what in fact we do as far as that for sitzis. So we'll continue tomorrow, Bez Hashem, and we'll finish off this matter of sitzis, and we'll continue that in the next perek, Bez Hashem.